Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and we've created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. And we hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. Thank you for listening. Goldfinger, Goldeneye, the man with the golden gun. James Bond escapism, or a guide to financial survival. From the Phoenicians to today, where China appears to have accumulated the largest gold reserves of any government in the world, it may be one of the few defenses against the money printing and currency debasement of governments, yet it continues to divide opinion. So it's timely to welcome my guest today, who's spent the last 30 years working and investing in natural resources and manages one of the largest gold mining equity funds in the world for BlackRock, itself one of the largest and most respected global asset management groups with a market value of over $80 billion. Evie Ambrose, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thanks, Simon. Pleasure to be here.
I'd like to start with the early days. You go to study at Newcastle University and take a degree in agricultural marketing. And I guess at that stage, did you envision a career farming crops rather than unearthing metals?
I was very lucky. I grew up with my kind of gold really as part of the overall conversation at home. My grandfather was one of the first British people to trade gold with people from the Middle East. And my father worked for a company called Mercator and Goldsmith, which was one of the largest bullion traders. And so when it came to thinking about doing some work in my year off between university and school, I actually ended up working in a gold mine in Australia. So it's been part of my kind of overall life from a very, very early point. And it's only really when I went to university and then got the chance to do some summer internships that I was fortunate enough to spend one summer with Julian Baring, who is the kind of the guru of investing in the gold space. And that summer of 1993, we had 10 investments in the portfolio that went up 10 times. And so after having seen that for only a kind of $100 an ounce move in the price of gold, which was engineered by Jimmy Goldsmith and George Soros, that was a huge bit of an addiction for me to see those kind of price moves in the market. So that really kind of got me across the line. So straight from university and into fund management.
Great. Well, before we talk about your thoughts as CIO of BlackRock's natural resources team, maybe we can just dwell on the role of bullion and of gold equities. For listeners, I'm going to reveal my hand, and that's that for nearly three decades, I've been a believer in the importance of allocating to gold bullion, and I'm inherently distrustful of paper monetary regimes. To be clear, paper currency regimes have a 100% history of failing to preserve purchasing power, and gold has a 100% history of permanence, and gold and silver have no risk of permanent impairment. I wonder what your particular thoughts are of gold in a wider context.
I think you're completely right. One of the advantages of gold is you can't print it, unlike paper currency. In today's environment where the cost has gone negative and costs you money to have your cash on deposit with banks in Europe now, I think gold has a serious role. And one of the big enemies of gold has been the fact that gold didn't pay you a coupon. It didn't pay you any interest. And so there was an opportunity cost of owning gold in the past that doesn't exist today. And therefore, it's no surprise to me that gold is completely recovered and is now kind of, we're now seeing a lot more engagement with our clients who are using gold as an asset allocation tool. And, you know, when I started my career years ago today, it was the default position of Swiss banks to have a gold weighting in their private client accounts. That disappeared in the early part of the 2000s. Today, we're in an environment where rates in nominal terms around the world are close to zero, and rates in real terms are strongly negative. So when you think about all of that together, kind of the perfect storm is starting to arrive for gold that should take gold prices to new highs.
You talk to these investors, but what would you think is the approximate both institutional and individual weight to the gold complex today?
Yeah, it's a difficult question to answer in terms of one number, because I think people allocate it based upon different perspectives on the future. So I think we, by no means is gold a standard allocation right now. I would say the minority of people have exposure to gold. If that was the majority, then the gold price would have another zero on it relative to where it is now, just simply because there isn't enough gold around at today's prices to accommodate the amount of money that would need to flow into it to be able to satisfy that kind of allocation. Maybe we're on an upwards curve in terms of general ownership, but today it's still relatively small. But for those people who do have it, I think that the most successful ones tend to have a mixture of exposure. So they would have some exposure to physical gold, normally via a gold ETF, and then some exposure to gold equities to give them the opportunity for dividends or growth and to give them that kind of additional upside you can get from a gold equity. And they would manage those two together within an overall exposure. So if you chose a number of 5 or 10%, if the gold equities had outperformed, they would take a bit of profit out of the gold equities and buy a bit of gold bullion, and the opposite if gold was outperforming gold shares. So I think keeping that overall exposure through time is the sensible thing. And that's what I tend to do with my personal portfolio. And now that kind of thing is starting to come back, and we're starting to see a lot of our clients really think about gold because of the diversification characteristics and wealth preservation that it offers for you.
And was there a gold bar underneath the floorboards in your home?
No, I wouldn't want to give away any secrets, but I definitely have some physical gold exposure.
And you had a nice story about discovering something in your grandfather's house.
One of the lessons in terms of the long-term purchasing power of gold was really brought home when my parents sold my grandfather's house. And when I went back to collect the things that I still had left there, there were boxes of school books and reports from headmasters who said that I hadn't been a great student. And one of the things I discovered there was an old wallet of mine that was sitting in one of the boxes, which I'd had growing up. And in there were some European currencies that no longer exist. So Portuguese escudos and some French francs, which were completely worthless. I mean, they were collector's items, but they were worthless in terms of trying to spend them. And then my mother, when I was leaving, said, oh, don't forget to take some of the gold sovereigns that your godfather gave you. And so the reality to me, seeing this weight all kind of completely worthless paper currency versus gold sovereigns that have been given to me as kind of long-term value by a wise godparent, and that really brought it home to me in terms of gold and its long-term purchasing power protection.
So I'd like to ask a different question, which is that you work for BlackRock. They manage, I believe, $6.5 trillion today with immense resources. And just maybe get us a feeling of what it's like to work for a company like BlackRock.
Yeah, so I've had an interesting career. I've never actually changed my role, but I've worked for about 4 or 5 different companies because we've been taken over through time. So I started off at Mercury Asset Management, and then I moved to Australia for Mercury. So I worked for a Warburg associate down there, but it's still doing the same role. Came back, worked in Canada for a subsidiary of Merrill Lynch, and then we got taken over by Merrill Lynch and then by BlackRock. So it's been kind of, I've had lots of different business cards, but never actually changed responsibilities. The power of BlackRock today is something that really is an honor to be attached to. The ability that we have to be able to get access to companies is phenomenal. The investments that the business makes in terms of research, investment into data analytics, risk analysis, all of our stewardship teams who help us with ESG, and the most recent initiatives, part of the business that we're now very close to, which is BlackRock Sustainable Investing. So all of these kind of incredible assets that exist inside the firm, you know, allows us and my team to leverage those to try and do the best possible job for the clients.
Right. So let's just stay with this idea of gold as a currency. We, on the Money Maze podcast logo, we have 4 currencies, sterling, yen, dollar and euro. In fact, some would consider, have considered that gold should be treated as a currency. I was intrigued staying with the James Bond theme that on Her Majesty's Secret Service, George Lazenby, in his only appearance as James Bond, he was, of course, Australian, is offered £1 million by Count Draco in gold to marry his daughter. Now, that was 1969. The pound bought you $2.8, which seemed to many awful, having been 4.5 after the Second World War. Today, it's 1.2. And before we think it's all about sterling, you know, the US dollar's lost 93% of its value since, I think, the beginning of the First World War. So let's talk about these gold companies. That is your principal focus. What do you look for in those companies, and how do you go about identifying them?
I work for BlackRock, but we also have geologists, engineers, and metallurgists working on the team as well. So we spend our whole day debating companies, debating opportunities. If we're not in the office, then outside of these unusual situations that we're in right now, we tend to be out visiting the assets and traveling around the world and seeing the gold mines and making sure the companies are doing what they say they're meant to be doing. So visiting an asset, seeing the engineers on site, looking at the rocks, making sure the gold is there, and doing our fiduciary responsibility with regards to what our clients are paying us to do. And that's really to try and capture the best possible exposure to gold via gold equities in the funds I look after.
But of course, people have said lots of things, many truths, some perhaps unkind about gold stocks, the place where money goes to die. Or I think it was again Julian Baring who said they were like lobster pots, easy to get into but hard to get out of. How do you think about quality of management, geopolitical risks?
I think the comment on lobster pots is actually different to that. That's not what he implied then. Was often some of the most attractive looking ones initially, but once you've got yourself in, you then uncover the perils of that investment, and it's often the liquidity dries up and they're impossible to get out of. So we used to have a lobster pot hanging above our desk, and every time someone came up with an idea of a small company that looked really, really attractive, we would write down the name of the company and put it into the lobster pot, monitor it for a few weeks. You'd need a cold shower after your initial brainwave just to kind of calm you down. And keeping that name in the lobster pot above the desk was a real lesson, because you didn't want to be the person who had the largest number of bits of paper in there come the end of the year. Now, I think the kind of concept for us of investing in these companies is really very simple. We look at the gold market and we completely understand the benefits of exposure to gold. So we always think about the fund in terms of trying to deliver exposure to gold, but via gold equities. And gold equities have additional volatility, but to compensate you for that volatility, they also have things like growth, exploration success. They have the ability to deliver dividends, and very much the things that gold bars can't do. So if you can manage the volatility of the gold equities in a way that doesn't concentrate too much risk and gives you those diversification benefits, then the gold equity portfolio should outperform a gold bar through time.
Given that there's been an historical behavior of gold management responding to a higher gold price by exploring more and not always returning money to shareholders, that some of the lessons in a more activist investment community, do you think there's been a shift in the way management try and balance those issues? Because they are, of course, sitting on mines with a shelf life, so they do need to explore.
So we have that advantage of liquidity. So we can move our exposure around through companies at different stages of their life cycle. So that is a risk that we try to manage by turning over the portfolio. We have a turnover about 25% on an annual basis. So it turns over 100% over a kind of 4 or 5 year period. And so that is one way of managing that risk, but completely right. One of the things that has happened since the former bad periods of management within the resources sector as a whole, and it's not just gold companies, is this kind of overinvestment into new capacity, the crazy M&A that took place at very high prices, the leverage that was taken on to the balance sheets, etc. You know, all of those things, the lessons from those were very painful. They cost huge amounts of return for investors. Those lessons have been ingrained into the current management teams. And today we have a very different investment universe where capital discipline is almost at the forefront. Despite today's high gold prices, we haven't seen anything like the equity issuance that we would have seen in previous bull markets, because we've seen so little fresh equity raised by the companies. And in addition to that, we're seeing companies generally massively increasing their dividends back to investors because they've paid off their debt. They don't have any big projects that are shovel ready in terms of construction. And therefore, in the absence of claims on that cash flow, management is responding by rewarding investors with increased payouts. And we've seen some enormous increases announced last year and even bigger ones announced this year as well. So it is an exciting environment for the shareholder.
And what's, if you were to describe the perfect backdrop for gold mining companies, what would it be?
Obviously, they benefit significantly from higher prices. And if higher prices are not accompanied by cost inflation, then those increased margins flow through to the bottom line. So we saw a great environment for the gold price in 2011, but we saw a bad environment for gold equities because costs were rising faster than the price of gold. So we had currencies that were going the wrong way. We had operating costs. So we had shortages of labor. We had higher material costs for things like steel equipment. And I remember stories of shortages of tires and so on. And there was a skill set that was lost in the industry through lack of investment in the prior years. So it was hard to get talented geologists and engineers. So costs were rising faster than the price of gold, and therefore margins were actually declining and gold shares underperformed the price of gold. Today, we're in a very different environment. The oil prices went to a negative number the other day. We're seeing currencies around the world be weak relative to the dollar. We're seeing just no cost inflation really at all in the industry. So this rising price is being fully captured by the gold equities, as it is in other broader mining companies as well, like iron ore, where we've seen this fantastic environment that we're in right now. So profitability is on the increase. So that is a huge tick in the box. And then from a kind of revenue point of view, gold companies today are enjoying these higher prices. I was shocked last year when it was announced that if you had deposits of euros in some of the leading European banks, you would actually have to pay to have that cash on deposit. So you wouldn't get any interest. You would be paying to have that cash on deposit. And the rate you would be paying would be more than it would be to have gold stored in their vault. So that just proves the attractiveness of gold on its own.
So let's broaden this conversation into the whole metals complex. Silver and platinum both at some point in March hit, I think, near 90-year lows relative to gold. So be interested on your perspective on both silver, which predated gold as a medium of exchange and has somewhat lost its way. And then from there, maybe we can talk about copper and what you see with the likely landscape.
Yeah, so we are in an interesting time with regards to the whole metals complex. If we go through them in baskets, I think the first thing to talk about is silver. People often refer to the silver-gold ratio, and you look at that and the price of silver had significantly underperformed the price of gold. And I think one big difference between gold and silver today is silver is much more of an industrial metal than gold is. You know, gold is still very much a financial metal. And so when you look at the uses of silver, they go into industrial applications. And so with the global economy having slowed down, the demand for silver therefore would be weaker. Now, had it hit an extreme point, it did look as though that was the case the other day. And so for the fund, we do have a decent amount of silver exposure and have taken advantage of some of that, the shift in that ratio to build that exposure, and that's paid off. In the platinum sector, we don't really look at platinum on its own because you don't really have a platinum mine. You have a mine that produces all of the metals that are associated with platinum, such as palladium, rhodium, ruthenium, etc. All of these metals together are referred to as the PGMs or platinum group metals. And you tend to have a basket of revenue comes through. So you might have 40-odd% from platinum and 30-something percent from palladium and then other revenues as well. So what we've seen recently is the performance of the other metals being extraordinarily strong. So commodity like palladium and rhodium have just been spectacular in terms of their price increases. So the basket price for many of these companies that produce these metals has been at record levels. And so the companies are enjoying enormous amounts of profitability right now. And so we've seen a real renaissance of interest into that space. And again, we've got some quite significant exposure to that in the portfolio. In the industrial complex, the base metals and things, the commodities like iron ore going into steel, we've had huge divergence in performance. So copper has been weak, whereas iron ore has been incredibly strong. Copper has now recovered substantially. It's 25-30% up from its low of this year. And I think each metal has its own supply and demand characteristics. And obviously, the big recovery we're seeing take place in China right now, with a lot of infrastructure spending attached to that, has seen a huge drop in iron ore inventories and steel inventories. And that has obviously propelled the iron ore price upwards, plus supply fears around virus outbreak in Brazil, which is a large producer. So the combination of those have taken the price of iron ore back above $100 a ton versus production costs of about 20. So you can imagine how profitable some of the big iron ore producers are right now. And copper is another significant exposure for us in our investment trust, the World Mining Trust at BlackRock. And that's a big part of the portfolio. And we've taken advantage of the lows in the market to rebuild that exposure.
And have you felt sort of almost obliged by geopolitical risk to weight the portfolio towards the Australias and Canadas and the USs of this world, as opposed to some of the exciting projects that exist in more precarious regimes?
No, we have a very much a global exposure. So having that geographic diversification allows us to have enough room in the portfolio for exposure to high quality geological resources with great potential, even though they're in risky countries. And another way of thinking about this is it's not just the perception of the country itself. It's what is the track record of that country? Have they changed the fiscal terms, which is obviously one of the biggest issues? So if you had a gold mine in Venezuela and the industry was nationalized, it's a disaster. But Australia has also been through lots of challenges with regards to taxation on resource assets. Countries like Canada have been incredibly safe, and surprising countries like Russia, where your natural instinct might be to be more cautious. But the fiscal stability there for the resource industry over the majority of my career has been incredible relative to other countries.
Obviously, the mining industry has dealt with things from Ebola to cholera, and so to a certain extent, it's used to interruptions. What do you think might be the changes in this sort of post-COVID?
Yeah, I think post-COVID is a huge unpredictable landscape right now. And there are so many consequences for the global economy and for people's lives in the kind of the new environment we're going into. And I think there are going to be huge changes. So whether it's the working practices that we see at the operations, like you might see in your office, that's one element that has to be dealt with. Most recently, some of the big challenges have been actually getting gold to market from the gold mining companies, because a lot of the refineries were closed. So there was a major shortage of London good delivery bars to meet the paper trading of gold that was taking place in the US. And so I think the post-COVID environment is going to have implications for all working practices, but I don't think the mining industry is any different to any other business in terms of having to evolve to accommodate that.
Let's turn to the world of ESG and impact investing. And I guess it would be easy to cast the miners sort of as the villains in the piece, but I think that would be a gross oversimplification. Tell us a little bit about how you think about your responsibilities in investing.
This is a big topic for me and for BlackRock. Sustainability is at the heart of many of the things that we do for our clients. The commitment by Larry Fink earlier this year in his letter just kind of really set that out very clearly for investors and for our clients. And so from my team's point of view, sustainability has been absolutely core, because effectively what you're doing by focusing on that area is trying to manage risk. If a company is operating badly, then they're going to lose their license to operate. Now, they might have a legal right to operate in the country, but if they don't have what we refer to as their social license to operate, then they might have every legal right to be there, but they won't be welcome. There'll be protests. The community won't want them. There'll be tourists that just won't be allowed to get access to their assets. And that's really, really essential thing for us to focus on. So when we go and visit the assets, it's one of the most important things that we try to do, is to come away from those site visits with a perception on how the company is viewed within the community and within the kind of the territory within its operating within a country. Because that will, to us, if they're doing the right thing, then that's one risk that if it's badly priced into the equity, that's a source of value for us. So it's something that we really focus on. So making sure that the companies that we're investing in are good citizens for the countries that they're operating in is absolutely essential. I think that one thing that the industry actually does a very poor job of, but I'm hoping it's going to improve, is actually standing up and telling the world what a difference they make in many of these countries that they're working in. You only tend to read about the negative headlines, and there are too many of them, and they tend to be only the biggest events that tend to get reported. But actually, the good work that goes on in countries, the investment into communities, the training, the healthcare, the schools, the jobs that are created, the infrastructure that's put in, you know, the dollars that are paid in taxation, both to central government, to local government, and into benefits funds for local communities, all of these go a hugely long way to helping many people and countries with the challenges that they face. So I don't think the mining industry does a good enough job in terms of outlining this to the market.
The last 25 years have seen lots of people drawn into finance. What advice would you give to someone thinking about their career? Are we short of geologists? Do we need people to think a little differently?
Yeah, I think the mining industry hasn't been the top of most people's lists of things to join. And there are definite skill shortages across the industry. But I think what we're starting to see more recently, and especially in the last kind of 5 years or so, is the role of the data scientist, the computer programmer. If you go to Western Australia now and you go to the big iron ore mines there up in the Pilbara, you won't see people driving the trucks anymore. Most of the trucks are driven by the robots. They're driven by operating centers down in Perth. So the whole role of data technology is changing the mining industry. It's making it more efficient than it had been before. And the results that people are getting out now are spectacular. So there is a role for data science and technology within the industry. There always has been, but I think that the role there is growing at a very, very rapid rate. So I would think, if I was thinking about setting out today, I would make sure that for my kids, that they can learn how to code. I think the role of data and technology is only going to grow in society. And I think the mining industry is going to be a beneficiary from people who are studying that.
That's very helpful. On your journey, were there particular setbacks and things that occurred which now you look at and think, well, actually, that was quite helpful, even if at the time it was not entirely welcome?
Oh, crikey, I've been through many ups and downs in my career, be they markets going from peak to trough and back up again and back down again. So lots of business cycles, but also personal challenges too. Investments that we've got wrong that have been very painful to explain to our clients and things that we've learned from. I mean, the most important thing about going through a difficult period is to come out of it stronger with better skills to be able to manage the risks that you're taking on.
And is there maybe one or two things from the investments that didn't work that have changed your process or have become red lines?
Clearly, it's about management. You can do all of the work necessary on the physical characteristics of an asset. So you can send, you can have one of my geologist colleagues to go down to an asset and make sure that the commodity that's in the ground is really there. And you can study the plant to make sure it's going to work. And you can do all of those, and you can read as much research and get as many independent views as you want. And you can understand the government and hope that the legal framework for taxation is going to remain stable for the period that it's been promised that it will do. All of those things you can do, but it's management. If management's going to let you down, then that is the single biggest thing that you need to focus on. And I think we've trusted some managements that we shouldn't have done. They've made us promises that they didn't deliver on. And maybe we need to do additional checks in cases. And we do that now more than we've ever done before. And so you mentioned earlier on the lobster pots. You know, one of the things to watch out for is over-promising by management and you getting stuck in an investment that you can't get out of. And when management lets you down, there's nothing worse because you're expecting that dividend next year and suddenly they decide not to pay it. You know, that's a big, big blow for your investment case. And when you think about an asset, especially a resource asset or a mine, there's only a certain amount of life for that asset. And if you're expecting the first few years to produce cash to pay off the money that's used to build it, and then the next few years to get returns as an investor through dividends and so on, if management decides to change tack and go and invest in something else, then that's a significant blow because 9 times out of 10, the next investment is not as successful as the first one and the management destroy the value. So that's something that we really, really focus on.
So I see that you're involved in 2 charitable projects. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about those.
Yes, I'm involved in a range of different charities. So the first one is the Burdett Trust for Nursing, which was actually a charity that was set up many years ago now by one of my relatives. And we have a foundation there that gives financial support for the training in the nursing community, but also it gives financial support to nurses who need financial help. And so that's a cause that's very close to my heart, especially with some of the difficulties that the nursing industry is going through today. So we're really hoping that that charity can make a big difference in today's environment. Another one is that I'm involved in is obviously the Julian Baring Scholarship Fund, where I'm not a trustee, but I have a role as an advisory role there. And that's obviously set up with the memory of my first boss in mind and some of the amazing work that he did. So we look to give financial support to students around the world to help them to get into the mining industry when they can't afford that work.
One final question, which is, I know you're a keen student of history. If you could have dinner with 2 figures from history, who might they be?
I do love looking back into history and in particular, the kind of First and Second World Wars. So probably go for Montgomery, because I think it would be fascinating to hear about his campaigns and what he went through during the Second World War. And then I think from a First World War perspective, to sit and learn any of the First World War artists who were able to capture the horrific images from the trenches in the First World War, any of those wonderful artists, and I would be honored to be at a dinner party with them.
I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but if some of our listeners haven't been, but I think if you go to the Imperial War Museum, there is that John Singer Sargent picture of the troops blinded by mustard gas walking hand on shoulder towards a medical encampment. Is that right?
Yeah, so the Imperial War Museum has an incredible collection from Paul Nash, Kennington, Nevinson. It's an incredible mixture of pictures there. And so any of those artists to me would be just be an honour to spend time with.
And so if you do have free time between all of the responsibilities you have, what do you like to do?
It's the countryside. So I live on a farm. We've been here for 12 years now, and we're doing things here to try and improve the environment. We planted miles of hedgerows, lots of trees. We've got big parts of the farm that are set aside for the advancement of ecology and nature. We're trying to rebuild the soil that's been destroyed by farming practices over many years and one of the major things that I've really loved during this period of lockdown is actually to be here during spring and seeing the whole place come to life. Because from when we moved here to today, the difference that you can see just in terms of the life around you is simply incredible. So that's my big passion, and being able to share that with my kids and family.
Well, Hemi, there's some very interesting thoughts. I've really enjoyed our conversation, and I'm going to take away, I think, two particular things, which is it's for the skeptics of the gold case, it's more difficult to be a skeptical given what maybe has been a shift from headwinds to tailwinds, particularly with the backdrop of monetary printing. And secondly, for young people, graduates and others thinking about careers, you make a very interesting point. The extractive industries are embracing data science and advancing with technology in a way that certainly I didn't get, and I don't think a lot of people will have appreciated. So that's helpful as well, because maybe the financial services industry is set to contract for the next two decades. So thank you so much for your time and the conversation. It's been great talking today.
Great. Thanks, Simon, and good luck with your podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you for listening to this episode. The Money Maze podcast is free, and if you liked what you heard, please write a review on iTunes or Google Play to help others discover the show. If you'd like to keep up with our work, please search the Money Maze podcast on LinkedIn, at Money Maze podcast on Facebook, or at Money Maze podcast on Instagram. Finally, you'll find other information at our website, www.moneymazepodcast.com. Until next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.